Hello, good people. It is so good to be here with our bonus episode series of The Heart Talks, where I interview guests that inspire me, who I hope will educate and inform you about things going on in the world that are very important to us all. And I try to find out about their journey, their life journey, what made them do the things they're doing now, the challenges they face along the way, and the vision for the future. And today, I got this amazing lady, and I don't want to be shallow or anything like that, but she's very cute. You know, she's rather beautiful. She could be a Miss Universe if she wanted to be, but no, she decided that she was going to do something with her life that was going to transform the world. And that is very impressive to me. So her name is Derval Barzi, and she is an environmental management professional with experience spanning the industrial and regulatory side of the Trinidad and Tobago energy sector. Her expertise includes risk management, environmental impact assessments, management systems, stakeholder engagement, and sustainable energy policy and project development. So very, very, very important. Derval holds an MBA in sustainable energy management and a BSc in Environmental and Natural Resources Management and Agribusiness from the University of the West Indies. She's also trained in energy efficiency management from the Association of Energy Engineers, solar electric design and installation from the Solar Energy International, and Global Reporting Initiative Standards for Sustainability Reporting. Derval is the host and producer of the Climate Conscious podcast, which advocates for action on environmental sustainability, climate resilience, with a focus on the Caribbean region. She's a member of the Clinton Foundation's Women in Renewable Energy Network and the Climate Reality Leadership Corps. Her interests include travel, yoga, permaculture, and social dancing. You don't know what social dancing is. Must be when you're social distancing and you move about a lot. Hi, Derval.
Hi, Eve.
It's so good to have you here. Now, may I ask, would you consider yourself a very left-brain person?
Left-brain?
If left-brain is logical and right-brain is intuitive, would you consider yourself a left-brain person?
It's still hard to say because I feel like I lean on both sides depending on the situation.
Oh, nice. Versatile.
Yes.
Well, it's good to have you here, man. I've been watching this lady. I can tell you a little bit about how long it took to get Derval to come back to me. She was very skeptical, I could tell you. I'm sure she wasn't sure about if she wanted to come on the show. It took so long to get this beautiful lady to come. But I'm glad I persevered and that she's here now. So, Derval, tell me a little bit about your background before we get into the environmental side of things. How it was in your life growing up? What kind of child was you? What kind of childhood did you have? What little things began to happen to make the Derval that we know now?
Sure. So, as you know, I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in an area that has a blend of both natural beauty and also industrial operations in terms of, well, you know, we are in Trinidad, we're known for oil and gas, but we also are Caribbean island. We have forests, we have beaches. And, I guess I had a pretty simple, comfortable childhood growing up in somewhat rural community, but I always enjoyed reading. And I also really enjoyed, when I went on to secondary school, I really enjoyed geography, which is where I started to learn about the environment and also not just the environment here in Trinidad, but also in other parts of the world. So growing up, I always had a creative side. So although I enjoyed my studies, I excelled at school, but I also always needed to have a creative outlet, whether some, I was a child that would write on the walls at home.
For real?
Yes. So I enjoyed being creative, coloring, writing stories, creating plays. Yeah. So I had a very,
So what did happen to you when you write on the walls? Your parents didn't write?
They did, you know, but so I would have been scolded until I eventually grew out of it. But they did encourage that creativity in me. They always provided me with books. I was involved in dancing. Mm. And so I would say I enjoyed my childhood. Mm. And I loved going to the beaches, which were basically walking distance from my home. So then thank you.
Oh, and you were about to say something when you went on what?
Yeah, so when I went on to secondary school and got into doing things like geography and biology, I think that is where I made the connection between my enjoyment of the environment and I got an appreciation for the different ecosystems that there are out there, not just the ones that I experienced. And so that really piqued my interest.
It's interesting because I used to love geography too, but I wasn't very good at it. I used to love it. It was one of my favorite subjects, but from the time they start making me do technical stuff, my brain just couldn't cope. It was just like, okay, I love all the idea of geography, clearly, but when you start taking me down to the layers of the earth and all the other stuff that's going on inside of there, I struggled a bit. But that's the bit you love, was it? The more technical aspects.
I actually like the, there's both physical and social, human geography. And I enjoyed both types of it because I also love learning about different cultures. Mm. And I guess that translates into my love of adventure and a bit of traveling, which we know is on hold right now.
Yes, how are you dealing with that?
Well, I was so fortunate that my last trip abroad occurred in February to March 2020. Mm-hmm. So I returned home just in time before the whole global meltdown really started to kick in and borders started to close.
Mm-hmm. So you must be a little bit psychic. You must have known that was coming up.
It's gone. It's all gone. Yes, yeah? So it was just perfect timing because I spent a month in India, doing some training there.
Oh wow!
And
is that where you met the last guest you had on your show?
That is true. Yes.
Oh, what's his name?
That's Dr. Nanda Dulal Das.
Yes, oh yes. From,
so at the training, we actually met persons from about 23 different countries. I was the only person from the Caribbean, so I had to represent.
And, wow.
I used West Indies to kind of draw a reference so that people could relate to where we are. So they're familiar with Brian Lara and Dwayne Bravo.
Of course. You mentioned the cricket. Yes.
Yes. Instant connection there.
Especially with India, of all places.
Yes.
Anyway, I take you off because I was getting excited. So we're going back a little bit now, chronological. So let me ask you this about your childhood in school. So there's you, this beautiful girl with obviously somebody who's got intellectual abilities. Is it the same there where you was at school? Where is it, an all-girls school or a mixed school? Let me ask you that first.
Okay, so primary school was a mixed school. And then secondary school was an all-girls school.
Yeah, the reason I ask you that is because I notice when girls get into secondary school and mid school, there's so much pressure on them to appear to dumb themselves down and pretend they're not intelligent. And I find in all girls school, you don't have that problem. So if you want to be pursuing intellectual interests, you don't have that pressure on you to be attractive to the boys by making sure you don't appear too intelligent. Did you have any of that going on?
No, I didn't have that experience. I think, we I guess if you had asked us back then, we would have liked to have boys at the school.
I bet you would.
But, possibly they may have been an additional distraction. So
Yes.
That existed, I guess, after school.
Yeah. Oh, but, I see. Go ahead, girl. You do your thing.
But I guess, you know, during school hours, the focus was, I guess, you know, interacting with your friends and trying to excel at school.
No, I love that. I love that.
But I do think that, I think it's important to have interaction between the both genders, you know, so I guess there are pros and cons to the two models.
There are pros and cons, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. But I do tend to notice, and I think it is actually a fact, that if you went to do the data, that people in single gender secondary school tend to do better intellectually and academically, but not so good, as you say, on the or interpersonal relationships type thing. They have to kind of catch it if they don't have the opportunity to interact outside of the school. So I've been in all this in my mind just to see what led Durva on her path. So you was in the right environment at the right time. So what was it like in Trinidad and Tobago when it came to talking about the environment when you was growing up? Was anybody in the general populace talking about it?
Not that I can recall. It wasn't really a mainstream topic. So it's only as I started getting older and I was led to study environmental management for my undergraduate degree. But I know some persons may have wondered why didn't I pursue maybe the sciences or maybe law, you know, those typical career paths that people propose or promote. But I was really passionate about understanding the environment. And but it wasn't really a mainstream topic or even a career field that people really encouraged.
Oh, I could imagine. And what was your parents like about it? Were they the same? Were they supportive or not?
They were very supportive. So I do appreciate that. They were very supportive of my decision. So it's only when I got to university and started diving into the course where I discovered climate change, that whole big issue, and sustainability. So I never regretted pursuing that field.
I'm very fascinated with your parents, you know. They sound like very individualist folks, individually minded, strong minded people who follow their own path. Is that a description? Is accurate or not?
Actually, my parents are very traditional.
Are they?
They are, but I think that they make an effort to support my development. And I think they recognize that the time that they were brought up in is different from the time that of my generation. They leave room for that, and I think they are proud of me stepping out and doing my own thing, finding my own path.
Yes, I completely agree. I'm just saying that most traditional parents would say, why aren't you being a doctor or a lawyer? And it's all very nice and well doing all this fancy environmental thing, but you gonna make any money from that? So it seems like they had a broader perspective, even though you say they're traditional. They seem to have very good parenting skills, I must say.
Yes, thankfully.
I want to big them up.
Yes, I think that's important. You know, as cliche as it sounds, thinking outside the box, especially in the Caribbean, where we have a lot of even creatives. And it's becoming a bit more accepted now, where people are pursuing non-traditional fields.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is a positive development.
It really is a positive development. I'm very fascinated by the human psyche and social, I suppose you would call it sociology, and the evolution of behaviors, because I see a lot of that with the Indian culture, the African culture, and the Caribbean culture, where it was very strict and you were guided and directed in a very particular way to become a certain type of person, and they expected you to engage in very traditional kind of careers. And now I've seen that in the creative industry, that a lot of African and Asian adults are now pursuing more creative paths, and they're being supported to do that now. And yet still that same strictness and that rigidity and that discipline that was instilled in them now helps them to excel in their career paths. So I find all it very, very fascinating to watch it unfold. And you being, as you say, this left brain, right brain, creative person seems to be another version of that, because you must have had discipline and you must have had a strict upbringing to do your homework on time and be this and be that to become the successful person you are. Not so?
Yes, that is true. I think it's important to have a solid foundation. So it's all about balance, mm-hmm. which I guess we all strive to maintain, but we don't always get it right.
No, we don't. No, we don't. So back to the environment. So now you saying that you get into this place where you were supported by your family, but you discovered that you got this passion, you went to do your BSc, but you had some people around you that were skeptical about it as a career path. When did it turn from an interest to a passion for you then?
Right. So having completed my degree, I started an internship at an oil and gas company. And that is where I was able to link what I was learning in the classroom and reading in the journals and the textbooks to the real world. And that is where it made even more sense, and it more or less reinforced that I had made the right choice, because it brought in the elements of not just environmental management as a skill, but also the economic aspects of why we engage in certain activities, such as oil and gas production, and the social aspect in terms of the other stakeholders that our operations interact with. And my skills came in there in terms of ensuring that certain activities, whether it's drilling a well, running a pipeline, or even doing a seismic survey, that these activities, which are done to generate revenue for the country, can be done in a way that safeguards the environment, and as well as it manages the impacts that the human impact or the social impact that project can have. So when I started to get involved in doing environmental impact assessments for real projects that have significant value and significant impact, it really, I think that is where it started to move from just being a skill or an interest to developing a skill to becoming a passion.
What were some of the things that you were observing that weren't being seen before then or weren't being done before then to minimize the impact of that kind of drilling, and that you now see that's changed and needs to change?
Right. So fortunately, there was legislation in place that mandated that environmental impact studies were done. But many times people saw this, like the engineers, they may see this as just a formality, just to tick the box so that they can proceed with their project. But I think an area where my work added value was helping them to understand why they should be concerned about the communities and the environmental impact. And by doing this, it might actually assist them in improving how their project is implemented.
Nice.
So seeing environmental management as an asset, as a value-adding activity, as opposed to being seen as a bother or an inconvenience. And I think that was an important shift.
I love that so much, because for me, that is the epitome of dealing with the corporate world. Because really, they want to know what's in it for them. It's like, that is what they're there to do, is to make money and make business. And they attract a very left brain type of focus. And if you're coming in to try and improve the way they do things, if you can appeal to what's in it for me and how will it impact me, allow me to continue to doing what I'm doing, they're much more likely to listen to what you're suggesting than if you go in there and say, you people are wrong, stop your drilling, you're ruining the world. So I can see why your approach worked very effectively. And it didn't hinder you, that you really are quite beautiful. I'm very, very, very impressed by this now, because I really think that is an approach that you're not going to change the foundation of corporation, who their basic purpose is to make money for the stakeholders. And so you have to educate them in a way that works for the rest of us and how what they're doing is going to impact us. So did you face any people asking you to not talk so much about the environmental impact for fear of what it might reveal?
I didn't really encounter any outright deniers. I think most people acknowledged it, but they may not have wanted to. They may have seen it as more work. So that may have been the deterrent. But again, it involves, you know, ongoing engagement with your clients or your stakeholders to, as you mentioned, bring them around to that position of understanding and embracing.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that since the challenges the energy sector has been, and I think it continues to be, a male-dominated work mm-hmm. environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, and coming into it as a young graduate, I guess you have to learn fast to be confident and to stand on your own and to not be railroaded by others who may want to just bypass what you are there to contribute. So it helped me to develop both personally and professionally being in that sort of environment and learning how to stand on my own and stand in my ability and with conviction that I know what I'm doing, in a sense, that I'm bringing something of value that is needed.
You know what I know now about you? I didn't know that you is the queen of understatement. That is what I know.
Why is that?
Because, listen, man, let me talk about the fact that you is a badass. Let's be honest about it now. If you're in a male-dominated industry, challenging the very foundations of how people work, and you describe it as coming up against some resistance, you know, this is enough to crush many people to not even pursue their careers, you know. So you saying this helped form me into this person, but you have to have a very strong sense of self to be able to be in a male-dominated environment, challenging them at the heart of what they do and how they do it, and find a way to empower yourself while you're doing it and still navigate it enough where you're not creating resentment between different parties. This is a badass personality. So I tell you, for me, you is the queen of understatement.
I mean, I don't mean to understate it in the sense that it wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just by the wave of a hand and you got over it. There were some serious battles, I would say, being both female and being young, because you went in there and you met persons who were old enough to be your parents, and they were not always as open to your ideas, you know?
Nice, because that is the point I'm making right there. It was not always open to your ideas. Now, for me, I've been there cursing and asking what he asked to do and getting very angry. And it wouldn't be very effective at all. You know what I mean? I'd be like, listen, right. You sexist, misogynist people, I'd be there all negative with my energy. And you be there all, okay, I see what's going on here, man.
But I must say, I had the good fortune of having a mentor and my supervisor who really encouraged me to challenge the established systems. And I had his support, Mr. Garrett Manwaran. And so that really gave me the space to grow and to challenge, and even when you get beaten down, to try again. So it helped me to develop resilience. And that is something that I will take with me throughout my career, because it is through challenges that we grow. Yes. And we do not like it in the moment that we are experiencing it, but
yes,
without them, we wouldn't recognize how strong we are.
Absolutely.
How creative we are. Because you have powerful to think of solutions. Yeah, exactly.
But you mentioned a really key point there because, you know, if you have the right environment and it's in a position where you are passionate about what you're doing, that is what will give you the impetus to keep going. And then you add a mentor in who is supporting you to be self-realized and become more of yourself, then that is how you have this combination of dealing with the challenges in a much more effective manner. So if somebody who wasn't like you, who wasn't passionate about it, didn't have a mentor and just found it challenging, then that would be a very difficult and different road for them. So that's why I encourage people to find their passion, because as Durval so rightly say, you're going to come up against challenges. That's what we're here to do, to learn and grow. So when you have a passion, you will sustain your interest no matter what. You will find a way to do what you want to do. So this is why I love that Durval is following her passion. And it's a really important message to you listeners out there to find your passion, to really go for things that you know that you could sustain no matter when the going get tough or the going get hard. You'd agree with that, Durval?
Certainly, 100%.
Mm-hmm. And so we sort of look at some of the challenges now that you face with that. So how did you evolve? Are you still in that position now?
No, I have since moved on to another organization. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I would have pursued my MBA that specialized in sustainable energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on to get some experience in sustainable energy policy for about 2 years. And then now I'm back in a core function that looks at environmental management.
Nice. So how does the Clinton Foundation Women in Renewable Energy Network fit into that? And the Climate Leadership Corps?
Right. So the Clinton Climate Initiative, they host a mentorship program. It's an annual program where they accept, they have two cohorts, one based in the Caribbean and one based in Africa. And so I applied and I was accepted into the cohort as a mentee for 1 year,
mm-hmm.
after which I graduated to becoming a mentor. So this year I am a mentor.
Woo-hoo!
And yes. So you establish a relationship with your mentee slash or mentor. And it's basically to allow women to realize their full potential, both professionally and I would say personally, because those two aspects of yourself are interrelated. We tend to compartmentalize it, but they are both linked.
So you say some more about that.
About the linkage?
Mm.
Okay, sure. I guess coming back to functioning in a male-dominated environment, you know, men, they leave for work or they get to the office, many of them have the luxury of just focusing on their work, the work that's in front of them. But as women, we have so many roles, so many responsibilities that, in a sense, it's impossible to just isolate yourself as just an employee or a boss.
Mm-hmm.
You are a woman and you have all these different roles that you play and you manage them. We learn how to manage them skillfully, but I think it's important that the world recognizes and acknowledges the multiple roles that a woman has to play. And I don't think that we are given enough credit. And I don't think that fact is accommodated in how our systems are designed.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, places an unfair burden on women who are attempting to excel or advance in the professional space.
Mm-hmm.
Because many times you feel as if you have to choose between personal and professional. Whereas it should not be so.
Absolutely not. That is so important. That's why I asked you to expand upon it. Because I know that this is things people can resonate with. And you can break it down into this is happening for women or this is happening for people of color or this is happening for people with disabilities. There's these barriers to entry or to moving past the glass ceiling in these fields. And it's really good that you who have managed to navigate it, managed to rise up in the ranks, as it were. But it's these kind of initiatives you're talking about with the Clinton Foundation that supports women like you to get further.
Yes, certainly it provides resources and it provides community and that network to allow women to advance in their desired space. So you have access to, first and foremost, you have access to a community or a network of women that can support you. Because, you know, the guys, they have their boys club.
Indeed.
So we, and that offers certain benefits. And we women don't normally have that. So that support is invaluable. And in addition to that, there are training opportunities to help you to develop certain skills, depending on which area you want to go in. So, as you mentioned earlier, the value of mentorship. So it really helps you to maybe gain clarity in terms of where you would like to go and allow you to resource up in terms of helping you to reach your goals. Mm. So it's a lovely community. And even though you graduate from the program after 2 years, you still remain a part of the network. So it targets women who work in energy in the Caribbean region. So it has definitely made a significant impact on me and in terms of me motivating me to keep pushing. Because sometimes you may kind of dip or you may plateau. Your passion is there, but sometimes it dies down, you know? Life happens.
Life happens.
So sometimes you need a little boost to remind you of why you started and where you were headed. And the Women in Renewable Energy Network has been that for me.
I love that you're sharing this because this is the third part talk I've done now. And I truly like to share not only your personal journey, but to see the common threads that we all face when we try to move through life in a positive way. I truly believe people deserve to live a life they love. And so when you pull out strands like this that are applicable universally, that I like to highlight them because this is my message to you listeners that if you're trying to focus on creating a life you love, a work that you find enjoyable and passionate, it is really important to surround yourself with positive people who uplift you, support you. It's important to be around people who know more than you, who could teach you things, who understand your personal struggle, because trying to do it on your own will exhaust the ass out of you. Forgive my French. I'm sorry. I just mean myself. It will exhaust you. And take a leaf out of their book and look for opportunities where you get to sustain yourself on the days where you're not feeling quite so I'm ready, I could do this, because we all have those days. So whatever you out there doing, I'm telling you, you need to find this support network, whatever way you can, because the world needs your passion and it needs your purpose. So right back to there right now. Now, let me ask you a question about this whole climate change thing in terms of supposedly first world nations compared to less first world nations. Do they pay any attention in the first world nations truly to the impact of climate change on places like the Caribbean or maybe even Africa, somewhere like that? Is there as much money going into that kind of thing or not?
Yeah, so the global community has acknowledged that there's a distinction between the industrialized and the non-industrialized world in terms of their contribution to climate change. And there are certain treaties or agreements, for example, based on your standing, you would be required to make a bigger effort in terms of reducing your impacts.
Mm-hmm. Your carbon footprint and all that kind of thing.
Yes. You know, but the challenge comes in where, first of all, these industrialized countries would have had the luxury of engaging in these activities that allow their population to achieve a certain level of development. Mm-hmm. And now the developing world is attempting to achieve this for their citizens, they're being told that you can no longer engage in this type of activity.
Right? That is hilarious. The irony. Right?
The irony. But the thing is, if you are saying, do not engage in X, then you need to offer me a viable alternative.
You have to offset it. Yes.
Right. And so there's a growing movement in terms of climate justice and even a call for climate reparations.
Nice.
You know, so to allow the developing world to continue with their development, but on a more sustainable path. And that is where sustainability comes in, because I agree we should not go down the same path that will be destructive to all of us in the end. But we need to get creative ways, creative alternatives that would allow us to develop our economic, environmental, and social well-being, as particularly in small island developing states, such as the countries in the Caribbean, which is where I am focused.
You couldn't have said it clearer than that. Because what you see here is some pomposity and nonsense. If they're trying to tell you it took us this long to even admit that we're having an impact on the climate in the first place, and most of you are still climate deniers out there in these first world countries, supposedly, and now that you now seeing the benefits of, basically you're seeing the money in working to create a system that has less impact on the world. Somebody show you how to make money doing that, and now you're listening. I know Derva don't agree with me. She's not like me. She's not cynical like that. But I can see that's one of the reasons that it prompted you people to start changing. And of course, all the lawsuits and things being brought against you. But you're not even thinking, let me see now, if I change all these practices and make them illegal, and the same countries that have been struggling because we went in there and mined and plowed their resources and make sure we make all the money we could out of it, and we are not giving them an alternative way to make new money. In fact, we should be playing more money into their research and development than into ours, because they're already behind on the curve. Then we know we just playing word games here, man. So I love the fact that there's this call for environmental reparations. Of course there should be. I love it. I'm very excited about that. So I want to ask you about these 17 sustainable development goals to transform our world that I discovered when I was listening to you chatting on your show. That is a very good education for me. So I got them here in front of me. I looking at them. I can read them out and you can tell me your comments about them. But some of them look like they shouldn't even need to be on there. Sorry. How is this even a thing? But still, let me read out the first three. So the first goal out of these 17 Sustainable Development Goals for the United Nations, goal number one to be reached in 2030, is no poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being. How are we doing on that, Derbeth?
Well, I mean, these 17 goals are really aspirational in terms of where we should all be heading ideally. And each of the countries are ranked in terms of their performance in the various goals. A challenge is in terms of data, having accurate and timely data to really measure, to really assess where we are. So, depending on where you are in the world, you may have either achieved or in progress or maybe slow progress on either of the goals. But I think all the challenges that we are facing globally are actually setting us back in terms of achieving many of the 17 sustainable development goals. For example, given the pandemic and the, you know, loss of employment for many persons, we know that we may be lagging with goal number one of no poverty. And then if we look at zero hunger, there is a big issue in terms of sustainable agriculture and countries, even in the Caribbean, being able to feed themselves, because here in Trinidad and Tobago, we import a lot of our food. We have a very high food import bill. So it's difficult to say across the board, but it depends on the local or even the regional situation that would tell you where you are standing with either of these goals, but I definitely think that the current pandemic, the current health crisis, and in addition to the climate crisis and the economic fallout, would definitely make the achievement of these goals a bit more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No doubt about it. I just realized if I was to read out all of these and expect you to comment on all of them, we'd be here till 9 p.m. So I can read them out and then we can have an overall take. So the other ones on here is goal 4, quality education. 5, gender equality. 6, clean water and sanitation. 7, affordable and clean energy. 8, decent work and economic growth. 9, industry innovation and infrastructure. That's very broad. 10, reduced inequality. 11, sustainable cities and communities. 12, responsible consumption and production. 13, climate action. That's number one on the list, God, without the climate, the planet, you can't do none of these things. 14, life below water. 15, life on land. 16, peace and justice, strong institution. And 17, partnerships to achieve the goal. Now, I am very inspired by this list, I would tell you. But it is a lot to be trying to do in 9 years. How realistic is this list, do you find?
Yeah, it is a lot. And we definitely have a lot of work to do. But I do agree that it's something that we all should be striving towards. Mm-hmm. And I guess each country would have to... We'll have to definitely examine their local situation and see where, because I believe that they may be further along in some of the goals than others. Mm-hmm. So each of them may not require the same amount of effort or emphasis.
Indeed.
But definitely, you know, one that is universal, all of the goals are universal, but definitely climate action mm-hmm. is one that, you know, every country and every region should be focused on. But also, if we look at the goal that refers to partnerships, mm-hmm. I think this is where we can make a lot more progress, maybe even faster, once we partner with each other and we share the learnings and also the strategies that can help us move forward. So you don't have to individually reinvent the wheel. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. 100%.
So it calls for a lot of collaboration and also recognizing the distinction between, you know, industrialized and developing and the challenges that the developing world faces and accommodating those challenges.
No, absolutely. And see each, as you say, each individual country or island with their own specific and unique issues to deal with, and then correlating to see where there's a match between what issues you're facing over here, where you're still trying to grow into who you're supposed to be, as opposed to you who already had all the income and the wealth directed your way, and bringing these two things together. So is there a Caribbean network just for Caribbean climate change issues and things?
There are several regional bodies that are looking at various aspects of it. But CARICOM would be the overarching organization, and they are doing a lot of work in terms of sustainable energy. They are providing both technical and financial support for countries to develop their resources, you know, because they require significant investments to get going. Mm-hmm. Their high upfront costs, for example, for developing solar or wind, and even some islands, they have geothermal resources.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that definitely CARICOM is working with other partners. There is some investment from, for example, the UAE. They have a fund.
What are the United Arab Emirates?
Yes.
Okay.
And then there are other multilateral agencies such as IRENA, the International Renewable Energy Network, and so they have funding and technical support that the region can access.
Mm-hmm. This is very good. Are you saying this now for people out there who get in their ears perk and are living in that part of the world and they didn't know what resources they had or could start with, that you could start checking out some of these places, some of these organizations? Maybe you want to start on a grassroots level with a, you know, just even trying this. What do they call it when you just grow things with water? Hyper something.
Hydroponics.
Hydroponics. There you go. Hyper. Hydroponics. They might want to start doing something as simple as that. So before we coming up to the end of the hour, I just wanted to ask one more question before wrapping it. And before I ask you that question, give me some examples that you have seen of climate change showing itself in the Caribbean. Have you noticed any different weather patterns or things happening more often than they were before?
Yes, certainly. A clear example would be the increased frequency and intensity of hurricanes that have come to the region. For example, Hurricane Dorian, which devastated the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing much more of these systems developing in one season, mm-hmm. right? And then more locally, we're seeing coastal erosion. Many of our Caribbean cities, they are located on the coastline. So that is impacting our infrastructure when the coastline is being eroded so significantly due to sea level rise. And I mean, that shows the global nature of climate change, because you may have ice melting in the Arctic regions and that translating to sea level rise here in our Caribbean region. We've also noticed, so here in the Caribbean, we have our predominant seasons, our wet season and our dry season. Right. And now we are seeing where the rainfall that you would have expected during the wet season, it has changed. The pattern has changed. So changes in the pattern of rainfall. And that is resulting in now we have incidences of flooding followed by droughts, because you have a short period of intense rainfall and then long periods without any rain. So our reservoirs are running low, and water is actually one of, going forward, water is going to be a very critical issue in terms of availability of water. And that is driving more countries to have to invest in desalination just to be able to provide their citizens with a supply of drinking water.
So that's where they remove the salt from the sea?
Yes. And that uses a lot of energy. You know, it's an expensive process to have to engage in. Yeah, so those were some of the key issues. Another one would be the sargassum seaweed, which has significant impact on our tourism, because we are known for our lovely beaches. Mm-hmm. And these seaweeds are becoming, well, they are a nuisance, and they are, you're seeing them more and more showing up on our coastline, and mm-hmm. then they start to decay and they smell and they attract flies. Mm. So, but I'm also seeing where in different islands, people are finding creative ways to utilize this sargassum seaweed in various ways. So, you know, we are creative people. Mm-hmm.
And this is really, that's wonderful for you to bring it down so succinctly, because I really do believe that out of these kind of life shattering possibilities, situations, innovation is bred, you know? And we see it again and again. You see it with these rubbish bins that they put in the water now to collect plastic. And as you say, people now looking at how they can use the seaweed to do something and make something beautiful out of it. And I do believe it does create. This is where the innovators and the visionaries come together and work in partnership to make something positive come out of this. So I really appreciate that. So my final question to you is, what is your vision for your future? How would you see your work going? How would you like to be, is there 10 years from now? What would you like to have seen change?
So last year I started the Climate Conscious podcast. Yes. Because I wanted to bring about more awareness of these issues that, you know, that we just discussed in terms of the Sustainable Development Goals and what it really means for us here in the Caribbean. And so far it has been well received. People, their feedback is that they are learning a lot. Mm-hmm. So going forward, I want to move from just awareness to action. I want to bridge that gap between awareness, which I'm raising through the Climate Conscious podcast, but I also want to move more into assisting persons and organizations really make that transition to sustainability. Mm-hmm. So if we were to look 10 years down the road, I see myself really contributing in that space of application of all these sustainability principles and actually seeing implementation and seeing positive outcomes from all this knowledge that I'm sharing at this point.
That is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's the Climate Conscious podcast. They can listen to it on any podcast platform.
Yes.
And you got Instagram as well.
Yeah, so you can find the Climate Conscious on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I also have the website, theclimateconscious.com.
Nice. Well, I tell you people to check it out because she has some marvelous guests on there. And I was happy to see why there was actually quite a few women guests on there. So it looked like the disparity is changing now. There's more women involved and out there speaking the truth, being powerful. I have a vision when you were talking of you doing documentaries, even a play. I don't know where that came from in my head. Maybe somebody put it in there and say, tell Derval, there's options too, you know, cause she admits some very good documentaries and bring together that left, right brain thing with she writing and she creativity that would really help to get people's attention who might not otherwise listen. So I putting that there as a dot in your head. If it grow, then I taking 10%. All right.
Yes, I'll put your name on the credits and you.
Just all I need. That's all I need. Really, I just need that. Derval, this has been amazing. I have truly enjoyed every second. I learned so much. I know the listeners learned so much. I think it would cause us all to think about how we can help to support these 17 sustainable development. And what impact we all have it. Is there any final words you have before we go?
I want to thank you, Eve, for inviting me on your platform and giving me the chance to engage with you and your listeners. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed our conversation. I'm glad we finally had the chance to do it. I wasn't hiding from you.
I knew you were just busy, man. I knew that.
Yes, but I really enjoyed it. You know, this is what I like, engaging with persons who are not necessarily in my field, but it is relevant to each and every one of
all
us.
All of us. As they say, the personal is political, but the climate is personal and you might die. So the whole world might blow up. So you can't get more personal than that. So let's just talk about the climate at the level it deserves to be talked about. Thank you again, my love. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Thank you again, Derval.
Thank you, Eve. Looking forward to hearing the episode.
Yeah.